Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Waypoint Radio. We have in the past, as I've noted, we're going to start introducing some interview segments into the Monday podcast, because it turns out as much as we try to play as many video games as possible, sometimes we don't have enough time to fill two whole podcasts, and so we're trying to broaden the horizons of what we can do on the Monday episode. And so feel free to, you know, write in, tell us your suggestions of folks you'd like us to talk to. But this week, I am lucky enough to be sitting down with, we'll get to us talking at GDC, but Andrew Schuldeis, the designer, creative director, like what? Someone who wears so many hats. What do you call yourself for the upcoming action adventure game Tunic?
That's a good question. If you have any suggestions,
you have to put something in the credits, right? Like you'll be listed.
No, it's blank. It just says my name.
Oh, so you despite the fact that you're like, you know, you're in the closing weeks of working on Tunic, are you just gonna cop out, just like not actually assign yourself a title?
I mean, it feels weird to I don't know. Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, like director, but everybody on the project is so self-directed that I feel like I'm not directing them. Good. I mean, I guess creator, visionary.
There you go. See, yeah, no, you might as well go for the big swing.
No, I hate that.
This is what I'm looking forward to. It's like whenever I get into playing, you know, Tunic in March, is the I'm gonna be less interested in what is the mystery here. Look at all these tiny beautiful details in the game. I'm gonna be wondering, what did Andrew decide to credit himself in the game?
I just posted. I did a capture of the credit scroll to post to the team and be like, hey, you know, check spelling, make sure everything's mm-hmm. correct. So if someone comes back and says you need to give yourself a title of some kind, then we will. But otherwise, maybe that's just how it's going to go.
So you had mentioned to me before we got started that I guess I should set up Tunic. Isometric action adventure game. There was a demo out for it. Was it last year on the Xbox sort of demo, summer demo thing?
I think that might have been when it first dropped. Yeah.
Yeah. It's you've almost certainly seen the very cute, adorable fox that's at the center of it. It's been compared to sort of a Zelda-esque Dark Souls sort of inspired in terms of its like mystery sort of adventure. And you mentioned to me that, like I said, prior we started recording, that we'd actually met roughly almost a decade to this recording date at a GDC back when I worked at Giant Bomb and I lived in San Francisco at the Game Developers Conference. And you mentioned what was I thought was interesting about you mentioned that other than time is forever and 10 years ago does not seem like 10 years ago, but I guess it is that, you know, you're working on Tunic and for a long time you worked at a casual puzzle adventure game company, Silverback Productions, before you kind of split off and to start working on Tunic. And I kind of wanted to start there, like, what, you know, how do we get from spending, I think I saw it was like 6 years at Silverback to Tunic? I don't know, like, talk to me about the games you were making while you were at Silverback.
We made a few different games there, but primarily the sort of the niche that we settled into was making hidden object games, which, if you're not familiar, these are sort of like Myst meets Where's Waldo sort of thing, where you sort of wander around. You're usually solving a mystery of some kind, and you need to just like find a billion screwdrivers and you use key on lock and occasionally do like a picture find. And we got pretty good at making them. They're fun things. But on the side for fun, I would do, you know, game jams like Ludum Dare or just, you know, stuff for fun. And at a certain point, someone asked me like, oh, are you ever going to make something bigger? Are you ever going to make something on your own? Yeah, at a certain point, it just was, if I don't do it now, when am I going to do it sort of thing? And it's not advice, you know, don't quit your day job. It wasn't a prudent move, but it was something that I needed to do at the time.
Is there, you know, any lessons from your time making like hidden object games that ended up in Tunic, despite the fact that obviously like on the surface, it might be difficult to see like A to B, but I have to admit, you know, you spend enough time building games of a specific type, working on games of a specific type that, you know, some of that would bleed over. Is there like, did anything from those years make it into Tunic itself?
I guess now that you mention it, sure. Like, I mean, very careful control of game state but more practically, there's like, one of the things we found is it's very hard to get people to read text on screen. If you explain to people what they're supposed to do, you know, big box of text that tells them exactly what they're supposed to do, the people will read it like, you know, 20% of the time, maybe, you know, through no fault of their own. You know, a wall of text is not a very interesting way to learn how to do something. So I don't know if I explicitly made this connection, but the idea of not really giving much direction to the player at all and letting them sort of experiment and figure things out and strike out into the wild unknown on their own. Maybe that's something that sort of worked its way into Tunic, which sort of lets you choose your own path in some ways.
Mm-hmm. I guess prior to, you know, working on hidden object games, prior to working on Tunic, like, what drew you to video games in the first place? Like, what is sort of your origin story in terms of just like games in general?
I guess my earliest memories of video games were probably Super Mario Brothers. Mm-hmm. And the most relevant story that I can think of that is a very early memory I have of that game is finding the warp zone at the end of 1-2. I mean, imagine being a child. And I don't know if it was an accident or it was putting two and two together. Like maybe I was, you know, thinking to myself, not playing the game, hey, wait a second, there's that elevator. Couldn't you just, I wonder what's over there. And you sort of walk outside the bounds of the game and text appears on the screen. And I don't remember how old I was at the time, but I'm pretty sure, 99% sure that it was probably the first time I had ever seen the word warp or the word zone. So I had absolutely no idea what was happening.
I've had a similar experience. I have a 5-year-old who has recently graduated from wanting to play video games because they just want to copy what dad is doing to like a genuine interest in video games, where like is asking for like one of the Switches in the house to replace like what otherwise would be like iPad time, like after dinner and things like that. And the game that really kind of hooked her was New Super Mario Brothers U Deluxe, which is an incredible mouthful of a name, but it's the Switch version of the Wii U New Super Mario Brothers game. And like one of the genius things that are in those games is like the ability for her to like hit L and R and then she pops in a bubble. And so like I was able to like help guide her through difficult areas in the game while she kind of was like getting her feet wet, just grasping what it was like to move in a space. And that's all to say, you know, now that she's kind of gotten her kind of the foundational knowledge of how to like at least move from left to right. I remember one time we were playing and I said like, you should try and go down, you know, like see if you can go down to that pipe. She's like, but why? Like, why? Like, I know I'm going to go forward. I'm going to find the fireball, try and fight the enemies. And like still to this day, despite the fact that that series has been iterated on a billion times, like it does at no point does the game like pop up with any tutorial text or put a big arrow that says, hey, if you press down on a pipe, you might go somewhere that's a secret. And it's not, you know, her discovery of that was not as profound as a warp zone, but it was delightful that something similar to that could still exist in a series that, like, you would think, oh, they figured out how to communicate all this to players. And of course, over the long span of time, they would try and make things a little more obvious. And to some degree, that is true. But just the simple fact of, like, there's a mystery down that pipe. We're not going to tell you that you could even do it. It's not necessary to beat any of these levels. Was like a real delight, because then she just spent like, well, now we need to check every single pipe going forward. And I was like, oh. I remember doing very similar things at that age where it's like, I just can't progress until I find out if this pipe also could go yeah. somewhere.
I mean, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves, but yeah, that's the idea. Finding a secret for the first time is not just knowing that you can go down this pipe. It's suddenly adding a mental question mark to every pipe you've ever seen or ever will see. Right? It's enriching the world in a way and making it a lot more exciting. And in the case of, you know, going down a pipe or finding a warp zone, the most exciting ones are the ones where you show up and you don't know what's going on, you know, like the meaning of it, like it feels very profound.
And it seems, you know, I played the demo of Tunic last year. And then I also remember playing it like back when I went to things like E3, and I think when it was, you know, there was a trailer at one of the showcases, and then so there was a build of the game on the show floor that I was playing around. But one thing that really sticks out about Tunic and seems to really have drawn you into kind of the game you want to make is the sense of mystery, is the sense of giving players options to figure out the adventure they want to go on themselves. And it's easy to see where you've landed, you know, years into the project and where that is has come out. But I'm curious, like, when you're sketching out that idea, when you're thinking about like the possibility space, like, I don't know, where do you start? What was the first thing that you did on building Tunic? Like, is it a line of code? Is it a piece of art? Like, what is like Tunic day one, even if you didn't know it was Tunic yet?
Good question. I think it was probably some amount of art design was one of the very first things. Like the world has this strong emphasis on sort of bounced light, you know, like the sort of ambient glow of the light of the world. And so some of the earliest experiments were, you know, what is it like to have, you know, the sun rise and see this, you know, world cast in light with this strict isometric perspective, and starting to experiment with things like, how do we deal with the player going behind things and you can't see them anymore? Do you do the outline thing? Do you swing the camera around? And I spent a lot of time trying to get to do that thing where the world sort of dissolves and mm-hmm. you can sort of see through. And that, I mean, I got that working, but it didn't feel right at all. And in retrospect, I think one of the things that ends up being sort of a very important part of Tunic's design is being able to slip behind corners and explore in places where it feels like you're not supposed to be. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like finding little secret paths and making sure that the world feels, you know, solid and grounded, and you're just this little friend sort of finding your way through it.
Why Fox?
Early on, I was not especially – so my background is primarily in programming, and I did a bunch of UI design back in my previous life. Mm-hmm. But 3D modeling was something that I had only dabbled in a little bit. And so the very first Fox was mostly planned on graph paper, like, oh, this is where the vertices will go. And because I wasn't super proficient in Blender or anything. And so I didn't want to be like, oh, you're going to be a human, because then all kinds of questions come up. Like, well, what is this human going to look like? And you need a character creator. So it's just easy to be like, no, you're the avatar for anybody playing this game is this Fox. And it sort of worked out, because it's a game about discovering mysteries and getting into trouble and things. And foxes sort of have that mischievous air about them. I would like to say that this is something that I knew from the very beginning, because of the nature of the combat, a fox having, you know, a big head that with this pointy nose and big bushy tail, orientation of like where your character is looking and stuff becomes sort of obvious and important. And, having that sort of arrow shaped player character sort of helps.
Having that sense of mystery. I'm curious, how do you maintain that? You know, the game's been, you know, you've been working on it for a number of years now. You see things over and over and over again. Obviously, you can get other people to play it, so you can kind of like get a sense of how other people respond to it. But like, how do you maintain that sense of mystery even for yourself as you become so intimately familiar with every little bit? I imagine it must eventually must kind of lose grasp of like what is and isn't mysterious when you've built it and stared at it for tens of thousands of hours.
Yes, absolutely. There's it has been bled of joy. It is nothing but a folder on my computer, with absolutely nothing interesting in it. That's a practical thing. I remember thinking really hard about this, like how do I not just, you know, stay motivated or whatever, because that's not an especially useful line of thinking, but how do I know if this still feels correct? Like, how do I hold on to this particular, you know, ideal of mystery or whatever, when it's like the mystery has been just shaken out entirely? And yeah, it's hard. I don't know if there's a good solution for it. I've tried a few things, like, you know how an artist will flip their work left to right.
Mm-hmm.
As they're working on it. I have a tool that will do that in level design. So I can sort of explore a space, like, quote unquote, for the first time, where the rendering engine flips it left to right, which is pretty useful for very specific things. Like, where is your eye drawn as I play through this? Where do I, you know, bumble my way? Like, is the direction that we sort of, like, quote unquote, want the player to go obvious, blah, 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 that sort of thing. But the larger question of, how do you maintain mystery is, I don't know, but it seems like, and I don't know, players will have to answer this for themselves, but it seems like we're on the right track. Because anytime, like, the audio design team, so Power Up Audio is the design team, and Kevin Regamy has been doing audio direction for the game. And there are other people on the team that have played Tunic less, and I have now just recently, like, gotten fresh builds and started to dig in again as we get ready for the finish line. And they've got back and like, wow, they, you guys really nailed this, you know, feeling of childlike wonder. It's like, yes, which is, yeah, I don't, it would be a nice back of the box quote if it wasn't from someone like on the team, obviously. But I mean, the demo, when it's gone out as well, it's whatever. Everybody's tastes are different, and maybe it doesn't land for everybody. But every now and again, someone will say, you know, I feel like I felt when I was a kid, you know, and that's very trite, I understand, but it is still heartwarming for me.
And so, you know, that kind of, that feeling of what it felt like as a kid, is it trying to recapture, you know, sort of specifically like the Warp Zone sort of thing? Is it more specific to like the Zelda influences, the sort of, hey, here's a game, here's a map, I don't know, figure out the rest? I'm curious what the kind of philosophical touchstones were for, like, trying to, I don't know, harness whatever feelings you had when you were younger that you're trying to put into this original work.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Warp Zone thing, yeah, totally. Like, just suddenly learning a truth about the world, that bit at the top of the screen is a place you can go, and just the ramifications of that, like, well, I could go past the, like, that's a very cool feeling. And I mean, people have brought it up before, but like Zelda 1 is sort of the example that people bring up of a game where, you know, there's a secret on every screen, and once you realize that, you're like, wow, every bush could be a secret, you know, let me try and, you know, it's like I mentioned before, it suddenly adds this layer of like, oh, I didn't, what does this mean? You know, this was the quote unquote, this was here the whole time. Like, that feeling is really important. And so, yeah, that's one of the things that, hopefully people will feel when playing this game.
I saw in a different interview you did for Tunic that you specifically mentioned, and this spoke to the Souls fan inside of me, that you were fascinated by like the poise stat in Dark Souls. I was curious, yeah, to expand, like, what you found. I guess, are you a big Souls fan? And then more specifically, like, what you found interesting about that, the point.
Sure. Down. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I enjoy myself a Souls, or a Bloodborne. And I think that's the poised. So people who aren't familiar, it's this sort of like secret hidden HP bar that refills. And the player has one and enemies have one. And it sort of represents how much damage you've taken recently. And if you've taken enough damage recently, then you'll do things like, you know, fall over or flinch when you get. Yeah, exactly. And that in and of itself is sort of a cool, like, oh, there's sort of this secret behind the scenes thing going on that means it just makes you realize that it's like turning over a rock and finding like, oh, there's all kinds of bugs under here. Ah, they were there that whole time and they were doing stuff. And it's spooky and I don't understand it, but it's there. And now I mean, bugs is a weird example, I guess, but the idea that like there's stuff going on that you don't fully understand. And I mean, poise is actually like really interesting and practical from a game design perspective, because it means that you have like another dial to turn, like, oh, this enemy is pretty challenging because you need to be sure, you need to learn that when I hit this enemy, it doesn't always interrupt the attack that it's doing or whatever. So there's interesting stuff there for sure.
It was one of my favorite stories that I chased years ago was, so in Dark Souls 1, the poise is an actual stat that you can like feed into through, you know, and upgrade and modify through different equipment that you carry. I think that was true in 2 as well. And they claimed it to be true in Dark Souls 3 because those games share a lot of, design DNA and sort of like how the stats like function. Like you can sort of expect, oh, they worked here like this before, it'll work here, there. And then when Dark Souls 3 came out, there were all sorts of items that said, oh, and this will impact poise. And like, again, like we said, the most basic version of that is an enemy attacking you, will you stagger and get interrupted? And what people found was that like they'd get to the end game, equip everything that's supposed to impact poise, and you would still get staggered by like the most basic of enemies. I still have never to this day, despite asking Hidetaka Miyazaki like directly, I was able to do like an interview for something with related to Souls, and so I was able to like, you know, I asked all the questions I should ask, and then like snuck in my degenerate poise question in there.
Yeah, your Simpsons xylophone question.
Yeah, because all right, a theory in the community had been that they just didn't flip it on, and that it was a bug, and because at a later point the game was updated, and then suddenly like poise started working how it was supposed to, or closer. And you know, I think Miyazaki's like quote paraphrasing was something like, "Oh, you know, we regret how we communicated the how poise did or didn't work." And I was like, "I think that's the closest I'm going to get to him to admit that it might have been a glitch in the game and they just forgot to turn it on." But that tension between sort of what players are discovering, they're if anything, that's an interesting part of like the layer of having multiple games where you can expect a sense of mystery, and then watching the designers play with your expectations as they work within that familiar framework. I think it's just so fascinating because it goes, what's different about today and like sort of the mysteries that, you know, you're talking about in a game like Zelda, or what you're harnessing in a game like Tunic, is when this game is released, people are going to open up the game and they're going to look under the hood. You know, that was not the case when we were playing games when we were younger. So I don't know, like does that relation, that more open relationship with players where you know they're going to be able to have a better, like they're going to be able to talk to you, they're going to be able to, examine the code of the game. I don't know. I mean, like, I'm curious if that influences how you think about what mystery means in a game now compared to, you know, if you were making Tunic for the NES or something like that.
For sure. So first of all, as we all know, video games of any size are ridiculously complex, and I do not begrudge any person working at FromSoft for accidentally turning off poise and then turning it on later, because I can, yeah, no, I can definitely sympathize with that sort of thing. There are certainly like, oh yeah, this feels much better, and then you check and you're like, oh whoops, I didn't actually change anything. So if people, you know, whatever, decompile the game and find out that I've made some critical mistake in the combat logic of Tunic, feel free to at me. Just please understand that this game has been in development for many years. with the vast, vast majority of the code written by one person, and mistakes are going to be made. And also, people will probably, if they do that, it's like we can't stop anybody from decompiling the code. And it's a single player game, right? We don't. If you want to mess with it, by all means, whatever. You'll probably find like a lot of weird unused stuff because a lot of combat design is iteration, or not just combat design, but in general is iteration. Like, this is a weird trashed concept for a thing, or this is a feature that was explicitly turned off for a reason. So there's definitely going to be stuff that people find in there. And as far as people sort of like doing what I mentioned before, where you like turn the bag upside down and shake out all the secrets, and then you're like, the bag is not interesting anymore because it has no secrets in it. I've noticed a couple of things. Number one, the community, at least surrounding the demos that we've done, self-policing is the wrong word. I don't like that, but the idea of someone coming in and saying, I figured out all the secrets, here they are, like copy paste. Like, someone could do that, and maybe someone would, but generally speaking, people have been very nice about being sort of offering oblique hints to one another when someone asks, like, oh, I don't know where to find this last item that was hidden in the demo. People will, say, oh, did you check the back of page 21 in the instruction manual? Or here's a series of emojis that is a sort of weird hint, or the, like good use of spoiler tags and whatever. So I think that there's this thought that, nothing can be secret anymore, especially with this internet thing. But people like mystery, people like not knowing. And the reason people are so sensitive to things like spoilers is because they want to experience things for the first time. And if they really want to go in and read a wiki or whatever and have everything spoiled for them, it's like, that's fine. Don't ruin it for anybody else. But generally speaking, people will play the game the way they want to play it, which is maybe, trying to figure everything out on their own.
Well, I actually think what's so fascinating about the fact that people now can sort of like dig in. I mean, there's a whole cottage industry, especially in the Souls games, of like, here's the cut content, here are the things that didn't make it in. If anything, it's sort of like, I think it's fascinating. It demystifies a little bit of like, what is it like to make a game, which is a lot of things are thrown out, like what arrives, in your disk, or I guess increasingly, downloaded to your console or PC. It's not a magical object like descended from on high. Like, as much as a company like Nintendo, I think, still tries to maintain that idea. They're like, no. Like, it's just here's the thing. It's beautiful. This is how it always was. Like, no, like they're really complicated raw objects that are never finished. And it's just, all right, we're done. Like, got to get this out. Like, it's just, and the things that are cut is the journey along the way to the thing that you are playing, like however you feel about it, like they're their own mystery. And I think a lot of what communities end up doing after the fact is trying to figure out, well, how did they arrive at this decision? And like, that's sort of the joy of seeing the stuff that is cut however you feel about the decision was made, being able to in some ways reconstruct the timeline of how that designer or team arrived at the decisions that they did arrive at.
Yeah, absolutely. Like as someone who enjoys like video games and how they are made, any sort of peek behind the curtain on that sort of thing is, it brings us back to GDC. People want to know how things are made, right? It's fascinating and useful and educational.
You worked on this game by yourself for an extended period of time before bringing on other folks to help in varying degrees. I'm curious when did you realize I need help? Did someone tell you, I think you need help? I imagine it must have been a big moment to go from having this like very isolated solo project to realizing, if I'm going to make the thing that I really want to make, I'm going to need folks to come in. I'm just, what was it like at that point to realize like, I think this team needs to be bigger than just me.
Right. So very early on, like from the very start, I knew that I could not do certain things, in particular audio design, something that I had bumbled around with a little bit, but it's like, it's not my jam. PowerUp Audio has been on board since very nearly the very start. And also I'm not a musician. And so I partnered up with Lifeformed, which is Terrence Lee and Janice Kwan, who are doing the music. And that was sort of very early on. That was me being like, hey, I've got this really awful looking low poly Fox. Do you like the video game? And they thought it was really cool and they were interested. And I also had the help of Felix Kramer doing some other things early on that related to like business development, like, you know, getting the game to shows and things like that, things that I was not super familiar with. And then eventually partnering with Finji to handle, you know, that it's the metaphor of like the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. Mm-hmm. And as I was learning stuff about like the horizon expanding or whatever it is, there's just, yeah, so much stuff that, you know, someone like Finji, they're extremely good at that I would have no idea was even a thing I needed to do. And so, yeah, they've been really instrumental and not just doing like capital P publishery type stuff, but also the sort of production support that is, hey, you should probably get some help finishing this video game. In particular, like going in and, you know, my favorite thing in the world to do is go in and place blades of grass exactly where they're supposed to go and have this rock just so with a chip off the edge, like, oh, perfect. But it's also very time consuming to do that. So we were fortunate enough to be able to bring on Eric Billingsley, who has worked on a number of projects in the past as a programmer. Like he's worked on solo projects as well, but he also worked as the lead programmer on Cuphead. But he's also a talented like visual artist. So he was able to go in and had the eye for like where to place the blades of grass and stuff. And so he's really helped to push.
So you never placed another blade of grass after you got help?
Oh, no. Late at night when you know, everybody's committed to the repo, I'll sneak in and be like, oh, I'm just going to put a blade of grass here. We collaborate quite a bit and hand things back and forth to sort of polish things up visually. And also he's a programmer, so he's able to, you know, go in and fix bugs and stuff like that.
Was it, because I know you mentioned before that, you know, people dig into the code, a lot of the code's, you know, built by one person. Like when you had to hand over your code to another person.
The most embarrassing thing in the world.
Okay. That was my thought. I didn't want to put words in your mouth, but I was like, I have a similar feeling whenever I like write a piece and then I have to hand it to an editor, but like, I write lots of pieces a week, a month, you know, a year. And so it's like micro versions of that. Whereas, I don't know, this feels like a much grander personal gesture that would be terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah, I built a clock that's made out of dirt. It's just falling apart constantly. There are people now. So we're working also with there are lots of people who are providing ancillary support for this as well, mm-hmm. including like a porting house and that sort of thing, getting it onto running well on Xbox. Yeah, just having them very patiently come back and be like, you really need to do this, and this. Because they're extremely professional and good at what they do. But it is, yeah, it's a little bit embarrassing to be like, yeah, I know this memory leak. Listen, I'm just a guy, you know?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And, you know, as you're heading towards this kind of Well, not back half, like the final. I mean, are you done with the game? Are you still placing blades of grass? Like, have you been banned from grass placement yet? Like, when is someone going to, like, hit your hand and, like, tell you, like, hey, this has to go through, you know, like.
Very, very soon.
Okay.
Yeah, we're getting to the point where it's like, all right, start to, like, we could do a few last minute big changes, but we got to slow down. And, like, QA has been doing a phenomenal job. Like, other things, other people that would make this, that have been, that this game would not have been possible without our QA team doing a great job going in and helping us, you know, do all the little fine tuning things. And yeah, so we're entering the phase of just like go in and fix stuff.
Right.
And that's it.
When you had mentioned, you know, despite having, you know, enough of a broad tool set to start prototyping, you know, what Tunic would become, but realizing very quickly that maybe music was not it. Did you at least, like, in that period, like, pull out, like, a Casio keyboard, like, attempt to, like, put some music into the game? Mm. Or was it just, I know I'm not even going to attempt to, like, make a swish sound effect for a sword and dump it into the prototype?
With music, no, because I had been listening to Terrence's music for he did the soundtrack to a game called Dust Force, mm-hmm. that he was also, I think, a programmer on. Yeah. And he did the soundtrack to the Double Fine documentary series thing. Yeah, it's the album is called Immerse, and it's truly phenomenal. You should check it out. It's anyway, I was listening to that a lot while I was first working on the game, and I was like, I want to work with this. But sound wise, similar to it being a bit embarrassing to show someone your code, I'd also put in some temp sound effects into the like combat prototypes that I'd made early on. And again, you know, Kevin and the rest of the people at PowerUp were very kind about my BFXer, you know, silly sound effects that I had put in.
Re-recording them into a microphone? Like, how? I'm curious. Like, what was the process at that stage?
It's like there are tools for making little synthy sounds for stuff. Gotcha. And yeah, I should go back to that and listen to those because they're really bad. But sound design is really fun. I like doing it. I'm just not very good at it.
Right. Sort of right.
Yeah. So I took a stab at it, so to speak, with the sword sound effects, but it's funny, like going from that to a conversation that I had with Kevin just yesterday, I think, where he was like, I need to spend time working on this, like the sound effect that plays when you start the game. And I'm like, Kevin, don't worry about it. Like we got, it's fine. We don't need a special. And then he's like, no, I already did it. Let me play it for you. I'm like, oh, that's so good. Forget everything I said. Never mind. This is awesome. And just, yeah. So having their sort of professionalism and dedication and skill is really elevating the whole thing.
How much, I saw you mention a different interview, maybe it was with IGN a year or two back, in which like, you finally felt like the game had taken shape or form, or you, I think, specifically said, like, I know what it is. And I don't know, what was the journey to getting to, like, I know what it is? Like, because obviously you can show screenshots, little, you know, clips of, like, the combat and exploration. But I got the sense from that interview answer that, like, that broader sense of, like, what the hell are we building was something answered, like, much deeper into the process. And I'm curious, was there like a moment where it felt like you knew it? Was that like a gradual process of realization? Like where do you arrive at the turning point of like, okay, I know what this project is. I know what it's, I know I could see an endpoint of how we could build towards that.
Yeah, for sure. So this sort of ties back to that question that you asked earlier about a game. What is it like to make a game full of mystery, but have nothing in it be mysterious anymore? And what that means is that early on, you're like, all right, mystery game time. I'm going to make a thing. It's going to have a feature. What's the feature do? I don't know. Isn't that exciting? I love not knowing things. And so the process of like taking this like extremely exciting sort of like vapor, this gas of cool ideas where everything's a little ethereal and doesn't have, and then realizing that's like, no, you got to like turn that into a physical, you got to like crunch it down and cool it down and let it sort of like crystallize and anneal itself into an actual product, like a thing that people can play with a beginning, middle, and an end. And that was that when any time that I had said, like, I finally realized what it was, it's probably at that point, I knew what it was more than I ever had before in the process. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of this gradual thing as it crystallizes. But yeah, that process was tricky at the start because of the thing that you talked about before, where it is extremely seductive to add yet another loose end.
Because then you don't have to cut it. You can always just say, well, I'll just keep walking in this direction. And so even though I'm scared, yeah. I'm not really sure what I'm building, like, well, if I just add another a layer on the road, I can worry about figuring that out later.
Right. And that's why there's a bunch of like, I guess it's not cut content, but like abandoned ideas and refined ideas. And like most of the things in this game have been redone at one point or another, at least once, sometimes more. And so that process of, instead of just making brand new things, starting to close those loops and making it more cohesive is the sort of thing that made me feel at the time like, well, that's it. No more mystery, right? But that's why it's so heartening to hear people having, at least some people having, a wondrous experience playing it, you know, like it's still having that mystery.
Did you find that, were there moments where, you know, I imagine over the course of years where you feel like, well, I'm iterating in this direction, we're cutting these things, so we're working towards a better version, but that you got to a point later, like, well, actually, I think that idea that we cut a couple of years ago was pretty damn cool. I think we should actually like to take that and shuffle it back to the front and
yeah,
make it back.
Yeah, totally.
In.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, it might be an apocryphal quote, but I think it's a Miyamoto thing that's like, an idea isn't a good idea unless it solves at least two problems or something like mm-hmm. that. And so, saying like, hey, we had this sort of dead end idea that was a problem because it was a dead end. We have this other dead end idea that's a problem because it's a dead end. Together, you have two fewer problems is very satisfying. Yeah, especially when it comes to, you know, a game about keeping things mysterious and not explicitly telling the player what to do, needing to be like, all right, what does the player have to do and figure out what it is, you know, sort of hooking all those things together and coming up with something that feels hopefully sort of mysterious and ineffable as you're playing it, but sort of as you start to understand it, has some internal consistency is, yeah. Hopefully it lands.
did you find that in releasing that public demo, in which, you know, you're broadcasting the game to a much wider audience than, you know, just showing it to press or your colleagues or the companies that you work with, was that part of the process of like figuring out like what this is and closing all those loops, or was it more just validation for which you already felt like this is what it is. Like, we've already closed the loops. Hopefully people like them. I'm curious, like, where you were at personally in that process when it was finally time to like show it to the world at like one of the, you know, in the biggest ways possible by slapping it on the front page of the Xbox store.
Yeah. Oof. So we had showed the game at, in-person shows in the before times and that provided it, because even that very relatively speaking early on in like 2016 or something like that, at the very first PAX that it was at, it was sort of like we sort of don't know, like the demo was just here's a bunch of the game that's built, wander around, which it turns out makes for a terrible demo, especially when there's like, you know, a lineup of people, which is a good problem to have, but we're like, yeah, we know we built an open-ended game.
Someone go to the Staples and buy a timer so that we can move on to the next person.
Yeah, no, it was and so later on we built these tighter versions of the game that were mostly like, hey, you have like half a teaspoon of exploration and maybe a tablespoon of combat, and that's really all the time that we have for it. And so those demos didn't on the show floor didn't really have time to show like overall structure to people. And even the Xbox demo is just like a really tiny sort of slice, not just of the space that you explore in the game, but also sort of like thematically, what are the things that you're doing and what does it feel to explore? Like we tried to capture those things as best we can, but so the feedback that we got from stuff like the recent Xbox demo is very valuable. It's things like, oh, we can fine tune this sort of like stuff from a combat perspective and like, you know, tweak difficulty a little bit get a sense for, like I was saying before, how what happens when a tiny little community forms, trading secrets and helping one another out? How frequently do people find things? You know, what motivates them? If there's this big skeleton enemy that utterly destroys them, we discovered that 99% of people just hurl themselves against the skeleton over and over again because it was a fresh challenge. And that was sort of an interesting tidbit. But on the whole, the thing that it's maybe not especially practical feedback, but it was something that I wanted to sort of keep close and like keep me warm at night while I'm placing Blades of Grass is that people seem to like it, you know, that it's that people are picking up what we're putting down. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that was good.
I think the question I'll leave you on is one that I like asking a lot of designers is maybe it's a blade of grass, but what is something in the game that you're especially proud of? You think is cool that, you know, it's not going to end up in a trailer. It's not going to be maybe something that, you know, people would immediately notice and put in a YouTube video of like the 50 coolest things you didn't know about Tunic, but I don't know, like it could be anything, but is there something that, you know, as you reach the end of this journey that you look back on that you've put into the game that you're like, I hope people take a look at this without obviously spoiling a mystery, but just something you're really proud of in the game that wouldn't be quite the headline moment, but you still think is extremely cool.
Sure. Yeah. There are lots of things that I'll let people discover for themselves. There's one thing in particular that no one knows about that is something that people may or may not find a little ways into the game that I think is going to be really, really fun to watch people find. But I don't know. I think like one of my favorite things to do is visual effects, you know? I guess generally speaking, things like, you know, little animations or sort of special effects or things like that. And, you know, shaders. And there's a candle flame in the game that is just, it's so tiny. It appears in a few places, but it's just like a few pixels on the screen. And I really like it. It's a sort of thing that is just a small little cozy task to work on, like make this candle flame really nice. And that's an example of something that every time I look at it, you know what? This game's all right. It's a good, good little candle flame. Everything's going to be okay.
That's great. I remember one of the first times I asked this question was with one of the designers of, it was like the ice expansion to Monster Hunter World. And I thought for a long time about it. And he was like, the way the camera swoops over the cats as they like, they cook the food, you only briefly see it, but it's, yeah. We worked really hard on it. It's super cool. And I was like, that's great. That's exactly what I'm looking for. So like the little flame is exactly the same type of thing. Well, Andrew, I sincerely appreciated the time. Tunic is out March 16th, right? Do I have
got it
correct? I can't wait to check it out myself. I really liked the demo. I was immediately charmed by a video game that, says it has like an instruction or dialogue box, and it says, well, you're just not gonna be able to read any of this, good luck. And I was like, that's a very bold move, Tunic. Like, okay, I'm curious to see where it goes from here.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about the instruction manual at all. It's got an instruction manual on the page for it, and yeah
it's got a lot of really very handcrafted, very a lot of tiny details that I'm sure you are excited for people to discover as well. But I want to thank you for your time. I don't know, is there anything else about the pitch that like I didn't get to? It's March 16th, Xbox, PC. Is there anything else I'm missing?
I think those are the main things. I mean, people can check out tunicgame.com if they want to sign up for a mailing list or whatever. But yeah, play it on Xbox on March 16th, and it will also be available on Steam.
Great. All right. Thanks so much for your time, Andrew.
Awesome. Thanks, Patrick.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Waypoint Radio. If you want more from Waypoint, you can follow us on Twitter at Waypoint, on YouTube at Waypoint Vice, on Twitch, twitch.tv/Waypoint. Our theme music is by Bo N. The track is Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. You can learn more about Bowen at waypoint.zone/Bowen. You can follow my work at Patrick Klupik. We'll be back later this week with a full-fledged, full-cast episode of Waypoint Radio. Until then, fuck capitalism. Go home.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.